This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, I'm going to open the March 22nd meeting and the Marysville Planning Commission to order at this particular time. And noting the presence of Planning Manager Chris Holland, and I don't know who else is here from staff.
Director Miller's here. Laura,
anyway, oh yeah, I see Haley there now. There was an icon of some kind that got stuck on my screen, covered you up for some reason. Anyway, do you want to do a roll call for the presence of the Planning Commission, Chris?
Sure, yeah, I'll just let you know that Matt Iyer's here from Public Works and Director Miller's here from Community Development, and obviously myself, Chris Holland, the Planning Manager, and we'll do a roll call. Commissioner Thefford? You're on mute.
I'm here.
Okay, perfect. Commissioner Michael?
I'm here.
Commissioner Hohen?
Here.
Commissioner Andes?
Here.
Commissioner Whitaker?
Here.
And Chair Leifer?
Yes.
Well?
I think we agreed to, if I'm not mistaken, to allow Roger to make a quick expansion of his first comment.
Well, I appreciate that. It was just kind of an emotional thing, but my daughter lives in Denmark. She looked online and found a mother and daughter from the Ukraine who were headed to the border. She drove like 24 hours over a couple of days or 2,000 kilometers to the Ukraine border in Poland, was able to make contact with them, took them home. She, on her Facebook, she chronicled her trip and got donations from friends and all to not only pay for her trip, but a nest egg for the Ukrainian family. So there's a little bit of good news that I wanted to pass on.
Yeah, well, thanks. That's an uplifting story to start the meeting with.
Agreed.
So with that, I'll ask the commissioners if you've had an opportunity to review the minutes of the February 22nd meeting. And if so, are there any corrections or comments to be made?
I got one, Commissioner Leifer. On the excused absences, they have me as Steve Andes. Either you were gone or I was gone.
You don't like that name, huh? Well, I'm sure that can be corrected. Anything else? Well, I'd entertain a motion to accept the minutes.
I make a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
Okay. Then motion made and seconded to approve minutes. All four. I can see. Well, I can't see Tom. I was going to say I'll just go by a show of hands on this. Hold your hands up if you're in agreement with that. I see everybody doing that. How about you, Tom? I can probably hear you.
Well, I have to abstain because I wasn't here.
Oh, okay. Well, the motion is approved. The next order of business is the, I guess I better not skip over audience participation by anybody that might want to address the commission on anything other than what's on the agenda. if anybody would like to do so, speak up. Or you see anybody there, Chris?
Yeah, we just have one person from the public here tonight, Peter. I think he's here for the third agenda item. But Peter, if you have anything you want to address the commission on that's not on the agenda tonight, please feel free to unmute yourself and get your name and address on the record. And seeing none.
Apparently not going to be addressing anything at this time. So let's move on to our first item, which is a code amendment, 2019 Stormwater Management Manual for Western Washington. And I see we have Matt Iyer here. Welcome, Matt. And I'm going to turn the floor over to you at this time.
Yeah. So this proposal is to amend several code sections outlined in the memorandum provided in the planning code to adjust for the adoption of the new 2019 Stormwater Management Manual for Western Washington. It's the manual that is the design guidelines for development. So with that, if anyone has any questions.
Yeah, Matt, I had a quick question on this. And how does this new code going to affect the areas in town that are being filled and raised 6-7 feet higher than the natural ground? Is there any changes to that?
No, those any project underway now would represent something that's been approved. And if they're grading prior to civil approvals, the groundwater separation requirements have not changed in this version. Majority of the changes are revised text to eliminate redundancy and fix typos from previous updates as they move things around. But the groundwater separation and then the subsequent design decisions made on those developments. That fundamental is not changing.
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead, Chair.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
I just had a general question. Was wondering if this code has been challenging sometimes for development in order to meet some of the code requirements for projects, in order to meet public works permits or so forth. I was curious to that front, not necessarily related to the amendment code update, but just in general.
Because the standards for Western Washington for all cities and counties are similar in that even if it's a design manual for King County or they are required to be of equal standard. And so generally the requirements are similar across the board. And it presents similar challenges throughout this area, this region of Western Washington. So I would say I couldn't speak to the difficulties they're having. I think it's the design process is always, my interpretation of the design process, it's always, there's always the hoops to build that design around, and this is it does have some challenges there, but it's kind of part and parcel with the region.
Okay, thank you.
And just to expand upon that a little bit, just if you just look at development throughout Marysville, we have a lot of different areas that some are very simple to do your stormwater, some are more difficult because of the height of the groundwater. So like the whole north end has high groundwater, so you have to raise your site and get your separation. And most of those developments up there are doing galleries underneath the parking areas and things like that, infiltration galleries. And then you obviously have the area that's, you can just go right into the city stormwater system. And that's the areas that you've seen develop mostly so far that are just west of Hayhoe Creek and north of 152nd, like the auto dealerships and things like that. So you haven't seen any grades being raised there, but then everything east of Hayhoe Creek, we're seeing just a tremendous amount of grading in order to meet that groundwater separation and put in their stormwater facilities. And so, but you know, you go downtown and whatever else, it's mostly developed with single family and all that. Instead, if you're way down south, we have tidal influence, but most of it's just Marysville sand, and you could run water on it all day and it'll infiltrate no problem. And then you go down to the southeast part of the city, which is mostly till, which doesn't infiltrate. So the cost is to build big vaults or whatever else to detain that water because you can't infiltrate. So it's just interesting, just different parts of the city have different impacts and different challenges.
Yeah, okay.
I'm glad I waited to last ask my questions until after Chris's comments. It kind of reinforced what I think makes a little bit of difference on the way some of these things are applied. For instance, there's a couple of things on there on a second page, soil amendments, and then the shortening the season for work from November to October. You know, that make all the sense in the world up on the hillside and different parts of town. But since Marysville is made up of so many different land characteristics, there are places around town that it wouldn't make any difference at all if work was being done in October as opposed to November. Same thing about soil amendments for a different reason. Though there's soils there's areas that need it and there's areas that don't. And I'm just curious, in the past, I was of the opinion that cities could promulgate and submit their own ideas as long as they didn't undermine any of the basic principles and still serve the purposes ensuring that stormwater was handled properly, the environment was all handled, in accordance with good principles. So I'm just curious if there's any thought about having a little flexibility there on some of this, or do you feel like we're just stuck in lockstep with whatever the state storm management manual says?
Well, in terms of developing your own manual or your own guidance, there's criteria that outline that, and that's a much bigger process because it would be something that would be done prior to the city's stormwater permit approval, and it would have to be equal to or greater than the required, or you know, meet a threshold as judged by the state to meet the thresholds of the same design standards that are put out in the manual. That's why agencies like King County I'm not sure if Snohomish County has their own design manual, but larger agencies will develop their own manual and get it approved. And then frequently other jurisdictions will choose to adopt that or adopt the design manual. In terms of the some of these things are like the temporary grading restrictions that outlines, areas where, measures can be taken if there's issues. And that just, aligns the months of the year to match what's in the other, permit documents and other, but that is there is inherent flexibility. It's not something that, that nobody can build in those months. It just provides that ability if there's issues that aren't being addressed, that there's other measures that can be taken. My understanding of our practices out in the field is used in a manner that's pretty reserved, but it does, those time frames align with what we've seen as the wet months of the year, and so that's prudent. In terms of the soil amendment, that's something that's a direct requirement of the state and of the manual. So that's just aligning those things. It's a process as the development standards are implemented throughout a city, and each city does it somewhat different. And I would say that we work to be compliant with the requirements of the state, and that's the goal, with while also being mindful of you know, common sense and the things we do have control over. So, but not sure if that answers your question.
Well, if I heard you right, I think there may be a little flexibility based on administrative considerations that might allow somebody to actually work on a site in October if it seemed justifiable.
Yeah, and I can kind of elaborate on that too, Chair Leifer. So on that page too, if you look at number three, it talks about director discretion and approval. I can't think of one site that has not been allowed to implement certain erosion control measures to continue to work throughout the winter. I can say that 2021/2022 was a super duper difficult year for all the development activity that's going on down in Southeast Marysville, as well as with the creek relocation up in the Edgecombe Creek up in the north end, and then as well as across the freeway on the west side with all the grading going on, 172nd South down to 156. Just a lot of, anyways, it's been a lot of work for our water resources team to, and our construction inspection team to try to get these sites buttoned up this year. And, you know, working with ecology and other things, a lot of ERTs, and I don't even know what that stands for. Matt can tell me what it is, but we get a lot of these ER complaints with tremendous amount of runoff, and just, we just had that, those tremendous amount of rains, if you recall, and it really messed the whole city up and all the roads and things like that. But I can say that there were sites that were shut down until they could figure out what they could do in order to continue to work, which meant bringing in big bunkers and things like that to contain the water, treat the water before it got released. But you know, we know all the development communities in a hurry to keep going as the market's hot. And the city works very closely with the development community to ensure that they can continue to work unless it's, the site is completely blown up. So I can't think of a site there was a few sites that had to get shut down this year, and they realized it. They had to button it up and cover everything up for a period of weeks. But for the most part, the city's been flexible in order to allow them to construct during those months.
Well, thanks for the input. Did you have anything else to say on this, Matt?
No, not unless you have any other questions or need any more information.
Is there any further questions of any other commissioners?
So we'd like to bring those amendments back for a public hearing, probably for maybe not the next meeting, but the first meeting in, I guess it'd be the second meeting in April, correct? Based on advertising and all that. So if you don't have any other concerns or questions where we need another workshop, we'd like to get it scheduled for public hearing. That works for the commission.
You know, I don't know if it's something that needs to be asked before or after we move to act on what you just said. But, you know, Matt, I don't know if you remember, but we had a discussion, it's been quite some time ago, about fill and the depths of it, and the necessity or not of it, and the, you know, extreme impact on the environment, hauling that excessive amount of material around. And anyway, you know, we had talked a little bit about trying to delve into that situation and maybe talk to Ken McIntyre. And I was just curious if you had ever had any opportunity to do that.
Yeah, we have discussed it to some extent. It is, that is one of those specific requirements of the manual, the current and the 2019, and to some extent, I mean, it's a design decision that's course, has taken in terms of the desire to infiltrate. And there's other potential avenues to design around that. So, I mean, some of that flexibility sometimes leads to, you know, that folks can design as they see fit, as long as it meets the requirements. And we have not pursued any sort of, or, you know, seen any pathway to around the that requirement for separation. And it's kind of been this manual, and I guess I didn't preface in the beginning of my conversation. So the way that the state required that, you know, they push this design manual out is through the city's stormwater MTS permit, the city's a phase two permittee, to that permit. And that it's the design manual's requirement to that, in that manual, a specific design requirement to adopt. We don't see a pathway in terms of avoiding that requirement. And I guess, sorry, I lost my train of thought for a sec. The one element that is emphasized in this that the state seems to have an emphasis on is this manual has elements of the UIC requirements, which is the underground ejection wells. So when infiltration occurs, the state considers that underground ejection wells. And so that's just demonstrating the state's understanding of the importance of protection of groundwater systems. And we've seen it with other cases in terms of groundwater protection for our unpermitted wells, the Hearst case, and other elements like that. So, and that separation is directly tied to that protection of groundwater. And that's the concept that they're looking to specifically address. So that's kind of the nexus of the issue. And if individuals choose to develop properties with infiltration and the groundwater is at the surface, that would be a design decision. There are other design options that are potential that could be explored, but that's that's part of that balancing act of the decision making that we see.
So Matt, for the education of the commission, can you maybe explain what Steve was talking about for separation? And you know, I believe it's 3-in-1 with the groundwater and mounting analysis and all that, but I'm not 100% familiar with it either. So maybe it would be good so they understand what Steve's talking about.
Can I make one comment before you do that, Matt? Just as a background, in the past, the DOE came up with their standard. They wanted a 3-foot separation, but with a 1-foot mounting analysis, mounting analysis, you could go down to 1 foot. And a lot of stuff was done that way, and it's worked well. Everyone that I know of has worked well that it was done that way. And there was a white paper written to support all that. And where I was coming from with my question here this evening is, they've raised their standard now to 5 feet, and following the same logic with the same analysis. I'm just curious why we couldn't say the same thing we did back then. How about if we knock off 2 feet and go to a 3-foot separation instead of a 5 with a mounting analysis?
I believe it's 3 feet. There's if it's impervious or pervious pavement, it can go down to 1 foot. Or if it's rain gardens, it can go down to 1 foot of separation with infiltration galleries, so perf pipes with rock, from the bottom of the facility to the seasonally high groundwater, they're requiring the 3 feet. And that's, so I guess to answer Chris's question, because the groundwater is at the surface, the designers choose to raise the elevation of the site so that they can insert that infiltration gallery that's rock and a perf pipe, and that allows for less loss of space of real estate to a pond or other facilities, and then to get that separation from the historic surface and where the groundwater was, they would raise that. They raise the whole thing up. So that's kind of the nexus of the elevation changes in the north end. At the time during that time, the LID was an option. It was something that the city sought to encourage through additional measures through code and other efforts. And so some of those efforts is what Chairman Leifer is talking about in terms of that separation, defining that separation. As we went into the 2012 manual, that's when the LID requirements became a requirement. And you're going to see some other code discussed today that touches upon that, where it went from an incentive-driven thing and something that we that was encouraged but not required through the design manual to spelled out requirement, and then they inserted specific requirements that were quite a bit more specific. So my understanding is there's not an element there to revise that unless you there's not, my understanding is not an element to revise that in the manual.
Anybody got any questions of Matt about that? Nope. Well, sounds like you did a great job, Matt, of covering all the questions.
Well, please, if you have any other ones or if you need clarification, it's been a long day, so I might not be thinking on my feet too well. So please let me know if you have any additional questions. I'll be glad to answer them.
Yeah, if you have any additional questions, Chair Leifer, or anyone from the commission, you can feel free to email me and I'll make sure we get it vetted and get it back to you before we schedule for public hearing or make sure that we have those things addressed for you for the public hearing. So,
yeah, one last comment, then we'll move towards trying to set this thing up for a hearing. It's probably obvious that I continue to push for anything that's going to save money for the consumer, the buyer, the homeowner, the business owner in our community. And these huge fills that are going on now aren't so impactful because of the excess of fill coming off of a couple of unique projects that are going on now. So you're not hearing anybody doing much squawking because they're trying to get rid of that stuff. But those are going to dry up and we're going to be sitting here with the valley trying to fill it full of business. And we got a neighbor just to the north of us that doesn't have to do that by the nature of their groundwater tables. And so we're going to find ourselves here down the road trying to compete with them, that their out of the chute cost is going to be considerably less than what it's going to cost to develop a piece of property in Marysville to get a foundation on it that's high enough to meet these separations. And if there was just a way of somehow reducing that a little bit, it could make a big difference along those lines. So that's my main concern with it. I guess I'll keep pushing until I'm done. Anyway, with that, are you guys ready to set this thing over for a hearing?
I'll move that we set a public hearing in a couple of weeks or so and move it on.
Is there a second to that?
I'll second.
Chris, I'm going to just go ahead and be consistent and ask you for a roll call on that then.
Well, it's not necessary for a roll call. If the commission's comfortable with us scheduling for public hearing, staff will do so and make sure it gets advertised accordingly and bring it back to you through the natural channels and make sure that we have enough public notice to do that. And I don't have the calendar in front of me right now to let you know what that date will be. But if it's not the next meeting, it would be the following meeting. So.
Okay, good. That's done. Thanks, Matt. Brings us to the second item under new business, which is a code amendment for residential density incentives. And Haley, it looks like you're on board for that.
That's me. Thank you. Good evening, Planning Commission. Tonight, we're bringing forward to you a workshop item related to amendments to Chapter 22C090, Residential Density Incentives. And I wanted to thank Kate Tortolo, who's not with us anymore. She did actually accept a job at the City of Monroe. She got us started on this code change and passed it off to me, and the other planners have helped with this too. So this chapter was adopted in 2003. And the purpose of this chapter is to provide density incentives to applicants in residential zones in exchange for benefits that help achieve the comprehensive plan goals and meet other criteria, make livable neighborhoods, and provide elevated standards for these developments. And recently, we have identified a need to update this code. It's been updated twice since 2003. There's been a few sections that were added. The low impact development standards that Matt had covered earlier in his presentation is an example of one of the density incentives that used to be somewhat cutting edge and was an elevated standard, but now, and you were able to get additional density for it, but now that's become the norm. The state requirements have kind of grown up around some of these regulations, so now they're outdated. So we wanted to make sure that we were still pushing applicants to provide elevated standards. So that was one of the changes that we made. There are also some regulations in here required for built green and LEED, and we wanted to identify a certain level in there so that there wasn't confusion with the applicants. So there have been some updates, and I'll just quickly run through kind of what we did. We did have some issues with applicants essentially using two benefits in the same area, and so we have tried to close the loop on that portion of it so that the substantially similar benefits can't be used for two different categories. The point is to choose a category and you apply for a benefit, and then you get the density incentive listed in this table. There is a item number 3 is a monetary contribution toward a project toward parks, roadways, bicycle facilities, pedestrian facilities, and multi-use trails. And the price per unit was $15,000, and staff is proposing to raise that to $25,000 per unit. And this is just to address inflation. I do not believe this has been updated for, looks like 10 years. If this was part of the update in 2011, if it was in 2017, then it hasn't been updated in a few years to address inflation there. We've also removed the historic preservation benefit. And the intent behind this was to preserve historic preservation, projects in Marysville. And as of now, we have one historic building, that's the Opera House. So we do not think this will be used and have proposed to remove this requirement. There has been some other changes. We're proposing to remove the perimeter fencing or landscaping requirement. And this is something we can discuss. I think staff did kind of go back and forth on this one, but it does appear that a lot of applicants are installing a perimeter fence anyway, because the backyards typically face the perimeter of the development. And we felt that was a pretty easy way to get density incentive credits for something that was happening anyway. And the intent of this code is to basically elevate the development in order to get additional densities above the base volume allowed. We've added a category for enhanced entry landscaping into a development to make the entrance look nicer. And we've assigned ratings for the different energy conservation guidelines in the code. We have removed the low impact development requirement for storm, since that is just an outright requirement right now. And we didn't add anything related to storm as far as an elevated requirement, because as we just discussed previously at Matt's item, you know, it is a lot to meet the state standards. So we haven't proposed an elevated standard, but we'd be open for feedback if the development community had any suggestions there. And then there was a benefit for pedestrian connections and walkability. And this is for city identified projects in the area that applicants would build and then get density credits for. And what we found was some of the projects were, more complicated, especially projects in the right of way where you may need to move a power pole or some other issue would come up. And the applicants that all attempted to address this benefit ended up just paying the monetary dollar amount that is another available option. So we're proposing to remove that so that the applicant can simply pay a fee, set it and forget it, and not need to design and go through the process. It turned out to be pretty cumbersome on all sides. And finally, we have removed the critical areas buffer enhancement credit. Proposed to remove this. There's a credit in here if you do additional enhancement for critical areas, and this has been rarely used. And we feel that if the critical areas elements are met in the code, that there is an adequate buffer that is there to protect the critical area, and that maybe other benefits listed in the table would be more beneficial to the city as a whole if those were selected instead. There are some other clarification clauses in here just on some administrative administering of this code. And we did add a clarification on timing and enforcement procedures. So overall, it's not a total overhaul of the code. I would classify it more as we're just updating it to be more usable for the city. And we did remove sections that we felt were out of date or that were something that was already required by the development. And the intent of this to get additional density would be to take a benefit from this list. So happy to talk through any of these items with the commission, and we're just looking for feedback during this workshop tonight.
I got a quick question, Haley, on item 7, the energy conversation item that describes the discussion going on with master builders and some recent questions relating to the option. I was curious what the questions were and how, and then what that energy conservation is. What's that starting to look like?
Sure. And I believe you're referring to benefit number 8 that you're talking about, section 7 in the staff report. Yes. So
energy, I was on your page 3.
Yep. Yep, that's perfect. So that section is related to energy conservation, and I believe before the code was basically exceeding what the building code had already required as far as energy standards for a building. And since that time, there's been a building code update in 2018 that further elevates requirements for homes and energy efficiencies. So that standard basically became obsolete, similar to the LID standard. So there's there's a Built Green rating checklist that's a separate organization that classifies energy efficiencies. And there's a checklist that the applicants are able to fill out. It's similar to the LEED program, but we actually haven't seen a lot of folks submit for LEED recently. And what we discussed with the MBA basically was what appropriate level should be assigned for the Built Green category. And that's a checklist that goes through. I wish I had the checklist with me. I can attach it to the packet next time if you'd like, but it's a checklist divided up into a series of categories related to energy efficiency. It has some site landscaping requirements, additional windows, and just energy saving checklist items that the applicant could use. And what we were finding was there were some applicants submitting the checklist, but they, after going through it, we realized they weren't really actually exceeding the building code. They were just doing the checklist. So we spent some time going through that and had a meeting with the MBA folks and the Built Green experts and decided that level 4 would be appropriate. That was indicated by the Built Green folks as something that is more than the building code, but not exceedingly difficult to meet. So we thought that would be a fair level to require. And then we threw a level on there for LEED as well. And I did send all of this to the MBA. They did look at the agenda. I don't think that they have anything written yet, but I would expect something from them before this gets adopted.
Those levels you refer to, that 4, is that a 1 to 5 or 1 to 10? Or I mean, is it like...
You know, I actually don't know how high up it goes. Do you know, Chris? I thought it was 5.
Yeah, I believe it's just 3, 4, and 5 is my recollection, but we can confirm that.
I had a couple questions. Looking first off on a staff memo that you prepared, Haley. If an applicant chooses to plunk down money, the $25K, where does that go? Where does that go towards?
It basically goes into its own RDI fund, and the city would prioritize that based on the list here. It could go to a road project, a pedestrian project, or a series of other projects. And Chris, do you know how it's historically been used, or if there's a prioritization level, or if it just maybe something that isn't funded gets funded? Do you know how that works exactly?
Yeah, so it would just basically be on a capital project that's either maybe slightly underfunded, or we need additional money for to go towards the grant funding that we're getting for a capital project. So it could be a parks project, a roadway project, a whole host of things that would be a capital and a benefit to the public. So at this particular time, there's not a, I mean, we have all these projects. We're looking, seeking funding. And as you saw this over in the paper this last week, we did get some funding for design for the overcrossing of 156 of the railroad. And then also funding for, I think, $5 million for overcrossing a grove with the BNSF railway. So if there's any money that needs to go towards that, the other project I can think of is there was a little bit of overrun related to Cedar Field with the lighting and the turf and all that stuff. And so some of the money could have gone towards that in order to fill that gap, you know, as funding becomes short. So there's not anything set. It's really, it's a pool of money that would be available for matching grant fundings for capital projects or anything that's going to be a benefit and is a positive project to the community.
So there's a chance it may not go to a capital project that would be helping spur along residential density. It could go to, you know, just a capital project where we're paving a new road, something like that. It could go to a host of projects, not necessarily geared towards a project that will help density.
No, it wouldn't go to anything that would necessarily help density unless it was like, you know, building a roundabout somewhere where we have a deficiency or a level of service deficiency that would allow you to continue to develop. Like there's, you can't meet level of service, and that's an identified capital project. So, you know, we have a 6-year transportation improvement plan and then a 20-year transportation plan. We got a parks improvement plan, you know, so it's going to go towards projects that are identified in all those different elements of the comprehensive plan and adopted plans. It won't go towards utilities. Those are already they're funded on their own. So it would go mostly towards roads and parks and things of that nature. So,
and on the last bullet for number 8 on page 4, kind of taking out the pedestrian connections and walkability. I understand some of the hurdles that kind of come into play with that and understand the reasoning for removing that, but from perhaps a philosophical standpoint, you know, if we're trying to incentivize density, that kind of is part and parcel with helping improve walkability or pedestrian connections. So I just worry that from a philosophical standpoint, are we removing a tool that could help us further improve density? And I understand the hurdles that are out there, but just from a higher level.
Since I have a little bit more background on that, I'll hopefully help with that answer, Haley. So we had a list of projects identified, and a lot of it was all in downtown, like around the schools, Asbury Field, and all of that. And then every time an applicant applied for that, they'd come in at the last minute, we can't do that improvement because now we've got to not necessarily acquire right away, but we got all these utilities in the way. We can't put the pathway in. We can't build the frontage improvements. We can't do this. And it was based on a lineal foot basis. And it just became so challenging that it seemed more logical to be able to, especially with the Civic Campus going in and all the gaps that we have down there around the schools and connectivity to Comfort Park with the improvements and then connectivity south down to the waterfront park, that monetary contribution could go a lot farther and ensuring that we have this connectivity around the downtown rather than having an individual project do 1,000 lineal feet or, you know, around a school. And that's what we really focused is around schools where there's gaps and for safety things. And so that's still on our radar to do. And it's part of our identified projects as a city, but getting the public to do it. And then you got to go out and do your own separate construction plans for that. So now you're designing stormwater, you know, in order to capture the new pavement that you're doing. And there's no place to put the stormwater because there's no, so anyways, it just became impossible for that to be implemented. And so the thought is that it would just be better implemented by charging that $25,000 fee per unit that can go towards a capital project that can make those actual improvements rather than just having something pie in the sky out there that ultimately nobody's end up using. I've seen it proposed three times and all three times over the last 20 years. All three times it was something that the applicant couldn't actually construct because the cost of it was so high in order to actually make the improvement that they chose something else off the menu, which is something they're allowed to do. So if the item on the menu isn't working, the thought is let's do something else.
So Haley, I had a question about the kind of the removal of the historic landmark piece. And when I was reading the current language, and it seems like the way that you guys are interpreting it is if it's actually something that's on the National Historic Register. And when I was reading that language, I guess I read that a little more liberally, that basically it's anything that either Marysville or Snohomish or the state might have designated historic. And I'm wondering a little bit about how removing that ends up interacting with some of the stuff downtown. And, you know, I mean, we'll set aside the Opera House because that's, you know, where it's at. But, you know, maybe some of the other more historic structures that are downtown.
Sure. And yeah, I think staff was interpreting it to mean historic landmark as classified by the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation. But we could, I don't see any harm leaving it in and saying designated as a historic landmark or as so designated by the city or some language like that, because there could be something that the city finds of historic importance. And Chris, feel free to weigh in here. I don't think it would hurt. I just would hate to be in a position where someone thinks there's something that's historic and worth keeping and they want credits for it. And then you
right.
know, staff is
right.
making the call. But I'm sure, you know, we could use discretion just like we do on all sorts of other codes, all codes, basically.
Sure.
That's my initial thoughts.
Who determines if it's historic or not?
I think that's the problem with we'd need to probably define that, and maybe the Historic Society or some other committee that knows more than the planners. Not saying that, you know, the planners don't know anything, but I think that maybe would be something better left for the experts to decide on. So we could add, you know, as determined by the Historic Society or some other group, if we feel that we want to keep it in there. But I guess the only historic landmark that's officially classified in town is the Opera House.
Yeah, and we work with the development community quite a bit when, you know, you have a structure, and I don't remember what the date cutoff is, but I think it's like 50 years old. Then before you tear that down, you have to go to DHP, which is what Haley called the historic preservation with the state, and have them, their SHPO, their state historic preservation officer, identify whether it's considered historical or not historical. And they, you know, you submit pictures and whatever else, and they tell you whether it is or is not. And that's what we've used it for. We've had a lot of development up in the north end that has old historic barns and farmhouses and things like that. And none of them have been designated as a historic landmark at this particular point. That doesn't mean that there might not be something in town that we're not familiar with. But in order for developments to go through, they have to make sure that they get that sign off on that. Just kind of a funny side story. The bridge over E.B. Slough was considered a historic landmark. And so before we got that replaced or whatever else, they were actually wanted to preserve that and take it somewhere. And how did you do that or whatever else? So what they decided to do is take a lot of photos of it or whatever else. So it's somewhere in a Bible, you know, that shows that as being a historic landmark and all that. So it's just interesting what is and what isn't. But that was just kind of a thing that was going to be a huge cost in order to get that bridge replaced there. And thankfully it wasn't something that had to be dismantled and set aside somewhere and then resurrected again someplace else. But anyways, just documented. So I think we're going to, Marysville will probably be in more of a documentation phase than it is for preservation stage, but that's not to say that something can't be given. And I just think about an Everett, the old house downtown that the folks wanted to, I think it was called the Foss House, that they wanted to give to the Parks Department in order for them to just retain and use it for different events and things like that. And so you're right, that could be an opportunity that we could discuss and come up with some language for something like that.
Unfortunately, most of the structures that would have met the muster to get into this category were tore down when the Marysville Mall was constructed.
Agreed.
Yep. And I think the one thing about this is that it's just saying that there's an incentive if you keep it, so it's not that you can't do something else. And then Peter chimed in on the chat that the county did a historic building inventory a few years ago that has properties that fit the definition of historic in quotes throughout the county, but many aren't on an official list with the State Department of the Interior.
I'm totally fine just leaving it in. I don't actually see a harm in it. You know, if the commission feels they'd like to leave it just to be safe, and maybe we tweak the language, maybe we don't, but these are all just starting suggestions for discussion. I'm not dead set on that one or anything. I think overall the standards need to be elevated so that, you know, there is a benefit for the density incentives that aren't out of date, but I think that one, it wouldn't hurt to leave in there.
Great. Thank you.
Anything else to be said on the residential density incentive issue? Do we need to set that up for hearing, Haley?
Yes, this would require a public hearing, and there'll most likely be a letter from the MBA group on this. It is adding, you know, an additional cost. I don't know if it's minimal or marginal. I'm not thinking it's much. I think it's just addressing current standards, but it's likely that they'll have a letter that, comments on a few of these, but I would just encourage the Planning Commission to to consider the fact that we haven't updated this in about 5 years and there's just regulations that grow up around it. So we want to make sure that, you know, the original intent of this is maintained. And if, you know, if we don't agree with the original intent, that's another issue. But the original intent was to really push the applicants for elevated standards. And we do our very best to work with applicants, we spend a lot of time with applicants working through these and making it as painless as possible while still upholding the code. So all of that to say, yes, we do need a public hearing, and I will include the built green information in the next memo. I'll leave the historical condition in there. And then there was another change we discussed earlier that I will make sure is in there and probably be ready for either the April 12th meeting or the fourth meeting. I'm not sure what the date is.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you.
We can move on to the third item on our new business agenda then, which is the East Sunnyside Whiskey Ridge design standards.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Leifer. So we workshopped this before. We have some commercial development that's occurring down in Soper Hill, Highway 9 area. And as that sewer gets extended, it'll be continuing to see more commercial development head up towards that break in Highway 92 access. Similar to the downtown plan, the sign codes that were adopted as part of this master plan and design standards are super restrictive. And staff feels that similar to what we did with the downtown master plan, it was to repeal the sign standards and implement the existing sign code, which has been updated quite frequently, and it seems to work for most development. And then we'd also like to take similar like we did in the downtown plan and move the design regulations that are in this standalone document that nobody can find into the municipal code. And so I haven't, you have attached the downtown the East Sunnyside Whiskey Ridge design standards and what those amendments would be. And it was essentially probably eliminate just section G, which starts on page 48 of that plan. And then also probably the definitions. I didn't redline those just because I want to double check that it matches up with Title 22A in our regular municipal code on some of those definitions. But for sure, the sign definitions that were in that section would need to be probably eliminated as well. And then just incorporate the normal, citations for how the municipal code is set up. So that just takes a little bit of time to get that all dialed in and make sure that it reads correctly and all that. We'll also probably be looking at some potential minor tweaks to design regulations. We don't have those quite yet for the group, but what we really wanted to do is make sure that the commission was comfortable with just implementing the existing sign code as within the East Sunnyside Whiskey Ridge master plan area. And again, those on page 2 of the memo there, it goes through that, and you've seen this before, you know, what would be allowed for certain monument and wall signage, which is really the big ones. And, you know, if you can't see the monument sign as you pass by and it's only, you know, it's 36 inches tall or something like that, it just doesn't do businesses very well. And we hear a lot of complaints about that. And I haven't seen any complaints on the existing sign code related to that. The one comments that we got before at the last workshop was related to maybe reducing some of the monument sign standards heights wise along 87th Avenue. Along 87th Avenue, the zoning designation from Soper Hill Road up to just north of the Highway 92 break in access is zone community business and zone mixed use. Currently in the code, community business can have signs that are up to, let me look at that real quick, sorry. I know the mixed use zone allowed monument signs up to 12 feet, and let's see here, I had the sign code stuff pulled up. I don't know where it went. But I'll find it. Here we go. And then in the community business zone, you're allowed signs that are up to 25 feet. What we're proposing here is to allow the 12-foot monument sign maximum for both the mixed use and the community business zone within Whiskey Ridge, but we'd be happy to discuss any reductions in that based on, you know, the prior comments and along that 87th Avenue corridor, because those are the really the only two areas that it would affect. In the residential zones, there's no, there'd be no effect for signage. It would all be the same. You'd have small monument signs for entryways into the subdivisions. If you were to have a home occupation, you're only allowed a small sign on either on your fence or on your building. So it's really not anything to do with the residential areas, which encompasses most of the East Sunnyside Whiskey Ridge area, but it would just really affect the community business and the mixed use zone areas. So with that, I will just turn it over to the commission with any questions you might have.
So Chris, I think that answers my questions. I was worried about having, you know, or allowing big signs throughout what is within Whiskey Ridge predominantly residential. Although in the spreadsheet, it does talk about, I just wanted to confirm that the proposed sign designs would only be in those zones and not allowed in the other residential single family zones within Whiskey Ridge.
That's correct. And let me pull up a map just so I can show everybody. I'll share my screen so you understand where the area that's going to be affected with these proposed changes. Share screen, where are you?
And I think 83rd Avenue is for the most part residential, although I haven't been up there in a while. There may be, you know, 100 new uses up there since it's being developed so quickly.
Yeah, there's a ton of development going on. Can you see that zoning map there?
Yeah.
So the areas that we're talking about are, so here's the Highway 92 break and access. So there's a little bit of commercial designation, this blue here, and then a little bit of mixed use to kind of buffer from the commercial to residential, and then the rest of the blue. So it really only affects any development that's along the SR9 and 87th corridor that are zoned mixed use, which is high density and allows for commercial uses as well. And then this little area just north of the break in the Highway 92 access. So I guess the only area that could potentially be impacted by a sign, although I don't think so. I think this is the 40th Avenue extension right here. There's going to be a big roundabout right here. Would be potentially this one with their neighboring, but we have a big townhome development that's going in right here that's already been permitted. So the rest of the area that's yellow and the kind of hashed orange and hashed yellow would all be for residential signs. So you wouldn't see any impact. I mean, you might have impacts temporarily to properties that stay as, you know, large lots, single family homes on a temporary basis as the commercial expands. But in the long run, it's all going to be developed with apartments in the brown is my assumption. And then commercial activity in the blue. There's no residential allowed in the blue area.
Okay.
Thanks, Chris. That was really helpful to have a visual.
You're welcome.
Well, are there any other questions about the design standards up in Whiskey Ridge? Well, that sounds like you got things covered pretty well, Chris.
Yeah, so I guess the next step for me is to get the code dialed into the correct format and then bring it back to you for a public hearing if you're comfortable with that. timing on this is not critical, but we do have one business and development called the White Barn that's anxious to continue to go on. There's a lot of grading going on and installation of stormwater facilities and things like that, but they don't have their sewer permits, water permits, road frontage permits at this particular point, but they're going to eventually want to apply for a sign permit. And I got to assume it's probably going to be sometime towards the end of the year for that area as they continue to move along. So we'll work diligently to get this buttoned up and brought back to you for a formal package for a public hearing. I can't give you an exact date, but hopefully sooner than later.
Hey, Chris, just to digress a little bit, when you were talking about other things, you brought up money for the Grove Street overpass and maybe 156 flyover and whatever. Was that all just strictly design money?
I don't remember. Haley's seen the presentation more than I. I don't recall what the cost was for the full overpass at Grove Street, what that number was, but I think was it $500,000? I think that's for design efforts for the overpass at 156. I think it was it $5 million and $500,000? Is that what I'm remembering correctly?
Five million. I believe it was for the design. That wouldn't be enough to build it with the pricing these days.
Has anything happened to appear that might be getting pushed a little sooner on the schedule than what it sounded like it would be according to Connect Washington's calendar? Any change at all?
Well, I got to assume no at this point, just because, you know, there's a lack of funding to do the HOV lane from Everett to Marysville and then do the on and off ramps there at 528. So I got to assume that they're going to try to keep that on schedule for the funding to come up with design in that 2027 realm. And, you know, I'm sure it'll be a design build. But I think things could change rapidly as businesses start to open up in the North End. So let's keep our fingers crossed that some money can be found and become available to expedite those projects, because they're certainly much needed.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Well, we've burned through our agenda. It's only 10 after 7.
Just a couple things. Couple things I had mentioned briefly before the meeting started. So we did lose a senior planner to the city of Monroe. Kate has taken a position as the planning manager there. And then Mara Wiltshire, who's our planning technician, who does a lot of the counter work and just general planning inquiries. She got a position with Snohomish County PDS. So both of those are out for advertisement. We actually have interviews for the senior planner position tomorrow, 3. So we're excited about that. And hoping we find a great candidate for Marysville. And then I think the planning technician position, we got notice today, but I don't know exactly when it will be published, but we're hoping that we'll get lots of good candidates for that as well. So it looks like it's a pretty competitive market related to the planning profession right now. But we're hoping that we get some great candidates that want to be part of Team Marysville. So
what's the starting salary for those two positions?
Haley?
The senior planner, I think, range is $95,000 to $113,000, and the planning technician is $67,000 to $83,000.
Thanks.
So Marysville typically pays a little higher than other cities around us too. So
do you require 4-year degrees for those positions?
Not the planning technician position. That I believe is a GED and some college experience. And then the senior planner would need a degree related to the planning field or similar field.
I think 3 years of experience, 3 years in a degree in some kind of a either planning or environmental or something like that.
Thanks.
And Roger, I want to just thank you for sharing your story. That's pretty cool stuff. So I'd be happy to share that with my friends. So that's great.
Yeah, I'm a proud dad.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah, that's a good story. Well, that's a good note to end this meeting on. We can think about that this evening.
Thanks, everyone. And like I said, if there's any questions, especially related to the stormwater stuff that you think of after this, just give me an email and I'll make sure we get them all addressed. So
do we have a motion to adjourn?
I'll move to adjourn the March 22nd Planning Commission meeting.
I'll second.
Okay. I'm just going to take my license to say goodnight then.
Thanks, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Enjoy your evening.
Bye.